As we mentioned at the beginning of the program, this week, President Bush unveiled his first budget, and as part of that, really the centerpiece, a tax cut, a $1.6 trillion tax cut over 10 years, something that he talked about when he was campaigning. Also, as part of his tax proposals, he talked about the need to get rid of the estate tax, what has been called the marriage penalty. And in the first part of the program, we're really concentrating on the issue of income taxes. And we'll be talking some more about these same things in the second hour of the program from a different perspective. Our guest for the program is Daniel Mitchell. He's senior fellow in political economy at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., a former advisor on budgetary and tax matters to the Senate Finance Committee. He writes columns that appear regularly in publications, including the Wall Street Journal and Investor's Business Daily. Before joining the Heritage Foundation, he was director of tax and budget policy for the group Citizens for a Sound Economy, and he has a Ph.D. in economics from George Mason University. He is joining us by telephone, and as always, questions, comments are welcome. All we ask of callers is people just try to be brief so we can try to get everybody in. But, of course, anyone who's interested in calling can do that here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Mitchell, hello.
Oh, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And thanks for talking with us today.
Glad to be on the program.
I think for people who take the position against the Bush proposal, their leading concern seems to be who it is that benefits from the tax cuts. And I want to ask you about the numbers. We talked about this quite a bit in the first part of the show. And these are numbers that have been generated by a Washington, D.C. organization, Citizens for Tax Justice. And I'm sure you're familiar with these numbers. A lot of people on Capitol Hill have been using them in talking about the effect of the cuts. And the concerns of some people are basically that the people on the very top end of the income scale get the largest share of the cut, and the people on the bottom benefit very little. And for example, what they say, their projections here at Citizens for Tax Justice say that the bottom 20% of taxpayers see an average tax cut of $47 a year. The wealthiest 1%, they get $54,000, 45. That's 45% of the total tax cut. So people are concerned basically about the issue of overall fairness and the fact that the people on the top are getting the lion's share of the cuts. And I guess I'm wondering just first of all, what you think about these numbers, and do you think that this organization, Citizens for Tax Justice, do they have it right?
Well, the first thing I would say is Citizens for Tax Justice has a very ideological viewpoint. They don't like tax cuts. They want government to be bigger, and a lot of their data is just flat out wrong. According to the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is neither Republican nor Democrat, you're looking at the top 1% getting 31% of the tax burden. But let's actually address the fundamental point here, because while their numbers are wrong, the general argument is one that should be discussed, which is who gets the tax cut. And when you're looking at the bottom 20% or even the bottom 50% of taxpayers, the first thing you have to realize is, according to IRS data, they barely pay 4% of the total taxes. And people in the bottom 20% pay almost no income taxes. And so when you're cutting income tax rates, it's very hard to give a tax cut to people who don't pay taxes. Now, in my mind, that's not really an argument against a tax cut. That's simply noting that some people don't earn enough to pay taxes, and so when taxes are cut, they don't benefit. Now, on the other hand, let's look at the top end of the scale. According to, again, IRS data, the top 10% in this country pay 65% of the tax burden, and the top 1% pay 35% of the income tax burden. And so if there's a criticism to be made of the Bush tax cut, it's actually that it's weighted disproportionately toward the lower end of the scale.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you're cutting taxes on a percentage basis more for people with lower incomes than for people with higher incomes. Not to mention the fact, of course, that all these numbers are based on static analysis, which assumes that people don't change their behavior. When, of course, in the real world, people do change their behavior. And what we saw in the 1980s, for instance, when Citizens for Tax Justice made the same kind of you know, demagoguery and class warfare arguments against the Reagan tax cuts, at the end of the 1980s, the rich were actually paying a greater percentage of the tax burden, even though they were the ones who supposedly got the biggest tax rate reduction. And that happened because of what supply-siders said would happen. When you cut tax rates, people have less incentive to hide, shelter, and underreport their income. So honest liberals who want to soak the rich should actually be cutting tax rates, because we want rich people to pull their money out of tax shelters, pull their money out of offshore havens, and put it to work for the American economy.
Hmm. Well, let me stay with this point for a moment, because I think that there are certainly people who would make the same argument that you do, that is, it's perfectly appropriate for the wealthiest people to get the largest share of the tax cut because they're paying all the taxes. However, some people would counter that argument by saying, well, there you're really only talking about income tax. And if you look at the total tax burden on Americans and you take into consideration things like what people are paying out of their paychecks for Medicare, Social Security, that in fact, that's when you look at who pays the taxes, look at total tax burden, it isn't true that the people at the top are paying the biggest share of their income in taxes.
Oh, I wouldn't disagree with what you say there at all. When you start looking at payroll taxes, that's a tax that has a very heavy burden on lower-income workers. And the president, in a State of the Union address, said, let's go ahead and address that system as well by allowing younger workers, particularly lower-income workers, to benefit from long-term private savings by being able to shift some of that payroll tax into personal retirement accounts. But you know what? I bet, you know, 100-to-1 odds that all the left-wing groups that are against the Bush income tax rate reductions because they don't help poor workers are going to be against the Social Security reform proposal. Why? Because their agenda isn't who gets tax cuts. Their agenda is to keep government bigger and to try to keep people, no matter whether they're poor, middle class, or rich, from getting any tax relief.
Let me then also, and I have a caller here, so we'll get right to this person. I promise I won't make him wait forever, our caller here on line one. But let me come back to one other point, that when Citizens for Tax Justice say that under the tax cut plan advocated by the president, the wealthiest 1% of all taxpayers, they're getting 45% of the total tax cut. If that's wrong, tell me what the wealthiest 1% will get.
According to the Joint Committee on Taxation, which is bipartisan, and actually, you know, on the right, we always argue they're too oriented towards static analysis. Hmm. You know, so they're certainly not on the right side of the spectrum. But the Joint Committee on Taxation estimates that the top 1% get 31% of the tax cut, and this, of course, is the same group that currently is paying 35% of the tax burden. And that's why honest analysis, non-ideological analysis, shows that, if anything, the Bush tax cut is weighted toward people of more modest means.
Okay. So, and when this organization says 31, says the wealthiest 1% get 31% of the tax cut, does this take into consideration how these taxpayers would benefit if another part of the Bush's tax plan goes into effect, and that is the estate tax is abolished?
Well, the estate tax is a separate tax. It's not part of the income tax. So, yes, I mean, if one was to try to take the death tax and try to distribute it across the population, then, of course, by definition, you're going to make everyone who benefits from an inheritance rich, because on the day you get an inheritance, of course, your income, you know, if you count that as income instead of just the transfer of an asset, your income goes up. So it's kind of foolish to conduct that kind of analysis. I mean, when we're looking at the death tax, we're really talking about a moral issue. Should government tax people a second time, actually probably a third time, because we tax income when first earned, then we double tax the saving if you invest it, and then we're going to tax it a third time if you happen to die and want to pass it on to your kids or whoever. And not only is that economically foolish, but it is just flat out morally reprehensible.
We are talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Daniel Mitchell. He's an economist with the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. And again, questions are certainly welcome. If you'd like to call in, the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, we'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. We have callers here on the campus to start on line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. First thing, I would rather see this discussion stay on the topic of who gets the tax cut rather than whose philosophy is about bigger government or smaller government. This is not about spending more. This is about giving a tax back to people. Having said that, I wanted to point out a point that was discussed in the previous hour by the previous speaker, that the people below the median income, have not gained anything in terms of purchasing power in the last 25 or more years. As a result, the income concentration in the upper 10% or less of the population has become even more lopsided, and that is the reason why they are paying more taxes. So it's kind of a circular argument to say that the lower people are not paying taxes in the same proportion and therefore they shouldn't get a tax cut. To begin with, the tax code was reformed in such a way in the 80s that the higher income benefits more, and now we are arguing that because they are earning more and paying more taxes, that they should get their tax back. This is quite illogical. I would like to hear some arguments that are more in tune with that kind of basic logic. Thank you.
All right. Well, Mr. Mitchell?
I guess I have a hard time divorcing this issue from who believes in a bigger government and not, because all the left-wing groups that are arguing against the tax cut, one of their biggest arguments is that this is going to give money back to taxpayers that we think would be better spent by politicians. And so if their agenda and their philosophy that is underlying their opposition to tax cuts is that they want government to be bigger, then I find it, well, silly, the notion that I shouldn't address the arguments that they're making on the other side. But I guess I would also throw in that while I think that the death tax repeal is mostly a moral issue, I also think there's an underlying moral or philosophical issue behind income tax rate reductions. A lot of the opponents of tax cuts seem to think that this pile of money belongs to the government, and it's unfair if the government decides to give the money to high-income people as opposed to low-income people. It's not the government's money. This is money that people are out there earning, generating wealth for our economy, keeping our economy the most prosperous in the world. And the question is, should we reduce tax rates across the board for all taxpayers? And if you make a lot of money, you'll get a bigger size tax cut. If you make a little money, you'll get a little size tax cut. But the whole reason for that is that if you make a lot of money, you're paying a huge pile of taxes. I mean, there's no question that if this tax cut goes through, Bill Gates is probably going to get a tax cut a million times bigger than me, just pulling a number out of the air. I don't get upset about that. Bill Gates is paying a million times more in taxes than me. I mean, that's the fair approach to cutting taxes. It's also the approach that's going to increase our economy's long-run performance, because we want to reduce the barriers that the tax code places on work, saving, and investment. I mean, for people who think that we'd be better off with high tax rates and income redistribution, move to France. Go ahead and be in a country with double-digit unemployment and economic stagnation if they really think that's the way to go. You know, they should actually go live it. And I think they'd come running back to America about as fast as they could, saying, please, give me a free market system.
So you, for those people who would say, who would articulate the concerns of the caller, who would say that the economic boom of the U.S. economy over the last 8 years has not benefited everyone equally. It has primarily benefited the people who were already at the top. It has further increased income inequality. And that for those people who would say that the tax cut proposal the administration has made will simply further income inequality more because it gives back more money to people at the top, you would essentially say, well, that's the way it is, and maybe that's the way that it should be.
I actually don't think that's the likely impact, but if that was the impact, I would say that America is a country that allows you to rise as far and as fast as your talent, ability, and willingness to work hard will take you. I mean, Bill Gates became a billionaire. Dan Mitchell, me, I didn't. Does that mean that somehow when Bill Gates became a billionaire, he stopped me from becoming a billionaire or he took money away from me? No, of course not. People in this country become rich because they're offering something of value to their fellow citizens, products and services that we voluntarily go out and buy. And if Bill Gates becomes rich because he made the rest of our lives easier by creating the software to power the technological revolution, then more power to him. If Warren Buffett becomes rich by being a good fund manager, more power to him. I guess I just have a problem with this whole hate the rich mentality. I mean, I think the reason that America has prospered and the reason that we've created this vast middle class is precisely because we have a system that allows entrepreneurs and risk takers to in effect go out there, you know, put a stake in a startup company, take a chance, you know, maybe 9 times out of 10, the company will go bankrupt, but then every so often you get these new technological outbursts of innovation, and that's been very good for our economy. Do you realize there's no such thing as a venture capital fund in a socialist country like France? And that's why there's no such thing as a Microsoft in a country like that. And we really do have to decide, in a global economy, do we really want to, in effect, put a ball and chain around our entrepreneurs with high discriminatory tax rates, or do we want an economy that's going to prosper, giving all people greater opportunities to climb the ladder of success, as opposed to this sort of static, negative, envy-driven class warfare mentality?
Yeah. I have several people here who are going to want to talk, and I would bet money take issue with you, or maybe not. Anyway, one thing I'm interested in your reaction to, and I don't really know what the position of Warren Buffett and Mr. Gates is on the tax cut, but Mr. Gates' father, Warren Buffett, George Soros, a number of rather wealthy Americans have indeed come out publicly and said they would be opposed to the elimination of the estate tax, because I believe they've argued that they're concerned that there would be a great drop off in charitable giving, and I'm just curious about your reaction to the fact that here now some of these very wealthy individuals, those people who you would expect would benefit if we got rid of the estate tax, would benefit more than the vast majority of the rest of the country. What's your reaction to them coming out and saying, no, we should maintain the estate tax?
Oh, well, I'm sure there are plenty of wealthy people who, for some reason, feel guilty about their success. But my view is, if we get rid of the death tax, there's nothing wrong with them in their will stating that they want 55% of their money to go to the government. I mean, if they really are silly enough to think that money would be better spent going to the government than going to, you know, charities or to their children or to whoever else they might want to give it to, there's absolutely nothing to stop them after we get rid of the death tax from giving that money to the government. Whatever floats your boat, if George Soros really thinks that the government spends the money better than his kids or the charities he would give the money to, let him do it. But he shouldn't let his guilt feelings at success interfere with the right of other Americans to pass on assets that have already been taxed 2 times to their children.
Okay, let's get back to the phones here. And again, I hope people will, you know, remember you're making room for other folks here too. So try and help us by making your points and giving the guest a chance to respond and then going on to other folks who are here in line. We'll start in on our line number 4. Hello.
Hello, number 4.
Yes.
Yes, I was just looking at some of the old tax tables from 1977, and the estate taxes, they started out 10,000, 18%, and they went on up to 2,780,800 plus 49%. Now there's $675,000 or $650,000 exemption for each person and their spouse, plus the other tax, like the tax planners have the different other programs, and you have been having deferred taxes when people have their HR 10s, and then there's the old tax law from years back where people can take their stocks, and rather than have their deferred taxes treated at regular tax rates, they can treat them as capital gains. And this postponed taxing, now we lower the taxes. You're talking about the more affluent. These people will get out of these postponed taxes. They'll get the reduction of that. I had it figured out one time, and I believe I mentioned over the station what it would cost the government in 1992 by lowering the taxes from 28 to 18% on just the IRAs that were out at that time. That didn't talk about the other deferred. And we've had the Section 179 depreciation, that's been raised. Now you lower the taxes. I think Illinois tax recoups from 1969 some of those expenses. Now, if you don't recoup those things, that seemed like an inequity.
Well, you've made some rather
it's double taxation. Tax property isn't taxed in this country. And out here, rural property is taxed every year, real estate.
Okay, well, if I can jump in there, because the first thing I want to do is to confess that I don't know Illinois tax law and the local property taxes and what Illinois recoups on things. And so, you know, when I don't know something, I always think it's important just to admit that right up front. What I can say, though, looking back on the death tax and some of the issues related to that, if you start from the premise, as I do, that government shouldn't tax savings that's already been taxed once, a matter of fact, twice before, then frankly, whether the rate goes from 55 to 28 to 18 or where I think it should be zero, the point is that don't double tax income, especially when the effect of double taxing that income is to punish people for saving and investing. And every economic theory known to man, even Marxism, they all agree that capital formation, savings and investment, is the key to economic growth. And so I don't think our tax code should punish people for doing precisely that.
One year we have a surplus. And how many years haven't we had a surplus? We talk about government. I'll insert that word people. It's the people's debt. It's the people's money. And your debit and credit, and it's your debt. It's my debt. And one man said he had more money to put in the bank back in the 80s because of the lower the taxes. I says if you paid less on the mortgage of your house, you would have more to put in the bank too, but your mortgage would still be there.
Well, that sounds like maybe the caller's making the argument for more debt reduction rather than tax relief.
Well, we have a $5.6 trillion surplus expected over the next 10 years. And, whether that's $1 trillion too high or $1 trillion too low, who knows? But the point is Bush's tax cut is only $1.6 trillion. And, of course, once you factor in the supply side effect, the actual size of the tax cut will be far lower. So there's going to be plenty of money to pay off the debt. As a matter of fact, too much money because a lot of the debt is 30-year bonds, and we just don't have enough debt out there to repay, unless we want to give like the Japanese Central Bank a big premium to buy back long-term debt that they're holding. So the real question is, do we want to cut taxes to cement our economy's performance and keep us number one in the world economy, or do we want to leave all that extra money in Washington so special interest groups, and there are Republican interest groups and Democratic interest groups, so I'm not making a partisan point, do we want to leave the money in Washington so the special interest groups can spend it? I'd rather give it back to the people who earned it.
I hope the caller will forgive me if I want to go on here because the lines are full and I want to give some other folks a chance. And we'll go next to a caller in Arcola, and this is line one. Hello.
Hi. Several quick points. One is your comment that the surplus doesn't belong to the government, it belongs to the people. I mean, rhetorically, that sounds fine in the sense that you have the implication that the government has something illegitimate, but the truth of the matter is we're a democratic government. We invested in our officials the power to tax us. The money in the government coffers is legitimately the government money, the government of the people of the United States. And so the argument that we ought to short-circuit the discussion on what to do with the surplus and that there's a moral obligation to return it seems to me not to be well-grounded. You have to look at the variety of things the money might be used on, decide what to do it, but to simply argue that it's illegitimate that the government has this surplus, I don't think you've established. The thing about the double taxation on the estate tax, you use some really hysterical language there referring to guilt feelings of Soros and these people. If you look at the argument they make, it has nothing to do with guilt. It has to do with their concern about the long-term well-being of the country of which they're citizens. And they believe that it's been well established, and you can look at Britain in the 19th century where you have huge estates that are passed on generation after generation, and this money in trust funds and so on is not in entrepreneurial hands. It's dead money. So if we have to fund the services of the government one way or the other, and there's nothing any more illegitimate about using an inheritance tax than there is that most states and local jurisdictions use property tax and tax it year after year after year. There's nothing immoral about that. It's simply a decision that the people have made that that's how they're going to fund the services that the people want to have.
Well, I guess I would make two points in response. Number one is that no one's short-circuiting any debate. This thing has to go through the House. It has to go through the Senate. There's going to be ample time for everyone to get all their arguments in. What I'm saying, though, is that from my perspective, in addition to economic arguments, in addition to global competitiveness arguments, in addition to arguments about the size of government, there's also, I think, a moral argument that it's just wrong to double tax someone because they die. Now, someone else can say, well, no, I think the moral argument is that we should tax that money.
You're making the assertion that there's no argument.
Philosophical perspectives.
But go ahead and make the argument. Why is it immoral? Rather than simply saying it's immoral, explain because, and explain by using analogies to different form of taxations. In almost every jurisdiction in the U.S., property tax is a way of collecting revenue. People pay on their homes over and over and over again.
And I would think that property just because someone died. So it's not just an income tax or a savings-related thing. But I also want to make
avoiding my question.
Well, I think I answered your question, but I want to also respond to the point about the death tax, about trust funds not being the entrepreneurial use of the money. You're exactly right, but why are the trust funds set up? The trust funds are set up precisely to avoid the death tax. If we got rid of the death tax, then people would use the money in ways that they actually thought made economic sense instead of trying to minimize their tax liabilities. We have this entire industry of life insurance underwriters and fundraisers and special interest groups that exist solely because of the death tax. Get rid of the death tax, and all that money gets freed up to be used for productive purposes, creating jobs for the American economy, boosting our competitiveness internationally.
The trust funds are set up to pass on money to the next generation, and you don't trust them to invest wisely.
Because of the death tax, that's why they set up the trust funds.
But, you know, again, you have asserted several times it's immoral for double taxation. But you have yet to make an argument on why it's immoral, because I pointed out to you that the home that I live in is not generating revenue year after year. It's a way that I save money, and I'm taxed on it year after year. If the inheritance tax is immoral, then one of the fundamental ways that state and local governments use all across the U.S. to raise revenue by that same token would be immoral. So explain, rather than simply asserting it's immoral, give us the connecting links. What are the premises? How does one get to the conclusion that it's immoral? You've asserted it over and over again, but you haven't given us any argument on it. And we see throughout our society, we use this form of not just double taxation, but if I live in my home for 50 years, I've been taxed on it 50 times.
But if you were taxed a 51st time simply because you died, then I would think that there would be an important moral component to the property tax debate. And that's what's happening here in the case of the federal death tax.
Now make the moral component. That's what I'm waiting to hear. Why is it
the moral
at that point,
which
but it's not moral?
What I agree with is that government shouldn't tax people a second time on their income simply because they have the misfortune of dying. Now, maybe you don't see that as a moral issue. I do see it as a moral issue. I mean, I also see it as an economic issue. I see it as an issue that undermines U.S. competitiveness. I see it as something that harms savings and investment. I see it as something that harms charities. I see it as something that blocks entrepreneurship. But I also see it, from my perspective, as a moral issue.
And I think we're about at the point where we've been over the ground a few times, and I'm not sure we're going to get any further. My apologies to the caller if he felt fault I was doing him an injustice. Let's go to Urbana Line 2. Hello.
Hi. I've got a couple things. One of them is regarding the estate tax. One thing that I've learned that is bothersome, even if they do end up doing away with it, is the scenario where it's not double taxed, that it's never taxed, where somebody in their lifetime, parents in their lifetime, have an estate that grows because of capital gain, and they are able to pass that off to their offspring without an estate tax, and that money, in essence, never gets taxed. It's sort of the flip of what you're talking about. I believe, was it a Representative Kyle that has proposed a compromise that would make sure that gain gets taxed at some point, which seems reasonable to me. The other thing is, I'm a little concerned about how far the two speakers' numbers have varied, and I'm trying to jibe them in terms of how much the top 1% pays or doesn't pay. And I'm thinking that in one case we're talking about the total amount of dollars that the top 1% pays, and in another case we're talking about the difference in the marginal rates. But when we have two people from opposite viewpoints diverging that much, you know, I would just like some comment on that. I wonder if you could explain.
Well, I mean, I can't really comment on why Citizens for Tax Justice came up with the number they did. I simply refer to numbers, not that the Heritage Foundation came up with, but numbers that the bipartisan Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation came up with. But even having said that, I think the argument shouldn't be about numbers. It should be about what is the right type of tax policy for America. And I think the right type of tax policy is to have lower rates to improve our economy's performance, to make our economy more internationally competitive. That, I think, is the real underlying issue with the rate reductions. And then, as I said to the previous caller, I think there's an important moral component to the whole death tax debate.
About the death tax, in terms of my first comment, do you understand the scenario I was talking about?
Oh, yeah, no, I as you were going along, I started thinking about answering the second part, and
right.
I forgot about the first part. The thing about capital gains is that when people purchase assets, like say they purchase stocks and bonds, they're purchasing those assets with after-tax dollars. And so it's not an avoidance of tax to then pass those assets onto their children or whoever they want to give the money to tax the capital gain when you purchase something with after-tax dollars is in and of itself a form of double taxation that we shouldn't have in the system. Now, if, on the other hand, if you got to purchase stocks and bonds and deduct the cost of those stocks and bonds, then you would be exactly right. It would be an avoidance of taxation to be able to pass it on without having it taxed.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. Let's go to Champagne next, line 3. Hello.
Hello, good morning. This has been very, very interesting. I think all of us agree that we're at a very, very critical juncture in our economy, and the decisions that we're making right now are going to be, extraordinarily significant, not only for our generation, but for the next. And it's precisely for that reason that I would like to caution the speaker and anybody involved in this debate to please avoid things like, asserting a moral right to your position. Please just say, this is my preference. But saying this is the moral position, and therefore if you take another one, it will be immoral, I don't really think that's going to get us anywhere. Nor do I say that anyone who would like to differ on specific policies or specific numbers in the tax cuts is necessarily to be dismissed as left-wing. It's very, very possible to be quite moderate, to be quite middle of the road, to really have the nation's interest at heart and to differ with you. And there's really no need to dismiss people as left-wing. And finally, this goes back to a much earlier point that we made when we talked about some very, very important entrepreneurs who have been very, very successful in our society. And I, like the guest, applaud them and their contributions. However, it's also possible to make the argument that we don't know how many other future contributors and future entrepreneurs are out there. And if we continue to skew income, if we don't pay attention to things like schooling and communities and people's health and, libraries, if we really don't make things more equitable, how many future wonderful contributors to our society are we really holding back? So I say distributing resources more equally is not hating the rich. It's simply giving others the potential to really be able to contribute and be important members of our society.
Well, the 2 points I would say in response. I guess I'll start by saying that morality, like beauty, is in the eye of the beholder. And I'm simply stating from my viewpoint, I think it's immoral to tax someone a second time on their income simply because they die. Other people obviously can say that it is the moral thing to do, or they can use economic arguments, they can use international competitiveness arguments, but I just think it's wrong, period. It's something that from my viewpoint, no civilized society should do something like that to people when they die. Now, in terms of your argument about what is the best thing we can do to ensure that we have greater opportunities for other people to climb the ladder of opportunity, to learn, to prosper, and I think that lower tax rates, empirically speaking, look around the world at the country with high tax rates, and you have much less income mobility than a country like America. Bill Gates was a college dropout. A lot of the wealthy people in America, aren't wealthy because their parents gave them money. They're wealthy because we have a system that, at least to a large degree, allows people to rise as far and as fast as their talent, ability, and willingness to work hard will take them. And I think that kind of system requires that the burden of government not be too heavy. That doesn't mean, of course, that you don't have libraries and things like that. I mean, those are things that I think, for the most part, state and local governments do a reasonably good job with. But I think we want to make sure that we have the underlying economic policies that allow people to climb that ladder of opportunity.
Well, yes, I agree. But I think it's possible that that economic policy would be a different one.
Well, I don't think that makes me left-wing or immoral.
I think we could just sort of agree to disagree.
Yeah, well, that's what makes the world go round.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call. Did I hear correctly? Did I hear a representative of the Heritage Foundation argue for moral relativism?
No, I was acknowledging that other people have a different perspective.
Of course,
would argue that my perspective is the one that is right and just, but I recognize that sometimes I don't persuade a lot of people.
We have about 8 minutes left, and we're talking with Daniel Mitchell. He's an economist with the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., and we are talking about the proposals that the Bush administration has made for tax cuts, $1.6 trillion over the next 10 years. And we both hours of the program this morning devoted to the discussion from two different perspectives. In the first hour, you heard from economist Mark Weisbrot from the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And then we have Mr. Mitchell with us here in this part of the show. And we are growing short on time. We have a number of callers. The lines are full. In fact, we will try to get in as many as we can. Going next in line to a caller in Chicago. Hello.
Thank you. In terms of taxation, the usual show business phrase, you ain't seen nothing yet. I believe that whether it's whatever analysis we're talking about, aesthetic, the ideological one, the honest one, what about the real analysis in terms of catastrophes, as the recent earthquake indicated is on our shores, and the usual hurricanes that create such catastrophes and disasters seasonally, and the other things that are occurring in the way of agricultural epidemics and pandemics of health that we're certainly seeing arising. And I don't know if the costs for taking care of these measures have been figured into the budget and accounts for things that have to be taken care of, like the infrastructure and the of the entire school system. So I don't know if all those things have been figured in to the point where we can say there's going to really be a tax surplus, let alone any incursions that our armed forces may have to make in other parts of the world. So I think this whole matter of the tax surplus is illusory, so I just thought I'd drop that in.
Okay, well, and let's get a response. As I know, Mr. Mitchell, that there are people who are concerned. They, again, make that argument. They say, if we cut $1.6 trillion, that's 1.6 fewer dollars in the federal budget, in the federal coffers, that we might then one day find we needed.
Well, there'll still be $4 trillion of surplus left over for these other things. And don't forget, when the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office puts together these estimates of future surpluses, they're incorporating not only the current level of government spending, but they're adjusting that level of spending up in future years to reflect things like the growth of the population, changes in government programs that would reflect these increased demands that might be put on it. And so it's not as if any of that $5.6 trillion projected surplus would require changing a single government program by even a penny. I mean, not to say that that shouldn't be done. I probably have a different perspective from your caller in that if there's an earthquake in Seattle, I think that's first and foremost something that the government of Washington State should be looking at, the city of Seattle. I think that there's in some sense an obligation on the part of homeowners and businesses to carry insurance policies. In other words, I'm not sure that we want to instantly say anytime something bad happens anywhere in the country that it's the job of other taxpayers to subsidize people who haven't taken the normal common sense precautions in terms of purchasing insurance policies and so on and so forth.
All right, let's go to Ken Mundy for another caller here. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to point out that there's a very interesting editorial in today's Tribune about a fair fix for the death tax, which says basically that do away with the death tax, but tax any property that is inherited at the cost that it was originally got at, rather than adjusting it for the current value on the day of the death of the person.
I assume that must be the same issue that was raised earlier about whether or not you want to impose a capital gains tax
yes.
on people when they inherit some property. And my view is that if the asset in question, the underlying property, was purchased with after-tax dollars, then no, I would not want to impose a capital gains tax because that would be double taxation and that would undermine the incentives to save and invest. And that, I think, would probably be the way most of those assets were purchased.
Okay, I'd like to make another point. Money begets money, and currently the rich in this country are growing richer faster than the middle class and the poor. The second thing is that where do the rich spend their money? They spend it a lot in villas on the Riviera and Mercedes so that all that money goes out of the country. The only justification for allowing people to have that much money is that something I saw on the History Channel recently, that after the third generation, most of it is wasted or squandered by the people who inherit it.
Well, you know, I think that's a great point. That's one of the reasons why I think people who are concerned about concentrations of wealth, I think those concerns are overblown, because if you look at some of these families like the Kennedys and the Rockefellers, you know, it doesn't matter whether they're Democrat families, Republican families, for the most part, you know, outside of the entrepreneurial generation that created the wealth, the subsequent generations pretty much just dissipate the wealth because all they do is spend it. Now, having said that, I might disagree with you on the other point. I don't want politicians and bureaucrats to have the power to tell us where we're allowed to spend our money. So if some rich person wants to, you know, blow their money on a villa in the Riviera as opposed to a villa in Santa Monica, you know, I think that's their right. It's not the role of government to tell us how we can spend our money. And some of us might waste our money. Some of us might, you know, be very frugal with our money. But, you know, like beauty and I guess also like morality, it's going to be in the eye of the beholder in terms of what's a waste of money. Some people have hobbies of collecting model trains. Other people might think that's a big waste of money. But let's just make sure the government doesn't get involved in telling us how we can spend.
We're going to have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. I want to say, Mr. Mitchell, thanks very much
for
talking with us. Our guest, Daniel Mitchell, he's an economist with the Heritage Foundation. And I do also want to mention that all the organizations we've mentioned, the Heritage Foundation, the Center for Economic and Policy Research, Citizens for Tax Justice, they all have websites. If you'd like to look at what they have to say on this issue and you have Internet access, you can go there. There's plenty of other information, too. And perhaps on other days, we'll be getting back to some of these subjects. But for the moment, we will have to bring things to a close.